Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In the spring of 1982, everything seemed to be going well for the Welch family, but 3 years later, both parents had died and the children became orphans. 19-year-old Amanda was on her own. Her younger siblings, Liz, age 16, Dan, 14, and Diana, 8, were dispersed to different family friends. More than 20 years later, the Welches have come together for a joint memoir titled The Kids Are All Right. And all four join me in the studio. Throughout the hour, you can join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome.
Thank you.
So glad to have you all here. This is quite a book. Who was the driving force in getting this book written?
Liz.
Well, tell us about that, Liz.
I actually had the idea. I knew I was going to write this book in college, and at that point, we were all split up still. After our mother died from cancer in 1985, the four of us were split up. Dan, Diana, and I went to live with different families, and Amanda went to live on her own because she was of age in Brooklyn, New York, and I was already a writer studying at Georgetown University, did my junior year abroad at the University of Edinburgh, and at the time was estranged from Diana, our youngest sister. She was living with a family in Bedford, New York, where we grew up, and the family was very proper, perhaps had the best intentions in mind, but decided that Dan, Amanda, and I were too wild, frankly, decided it was best for Diana to not spend time with us and to be instead enveloped into their family. And I'm sure Diana will talk a little bit about, you know, she even had to give up her name, and she became a Chamberlain over the 5 years that we were estranged
and
from her.
And lost the name Welch, Diana.
I did, yeah, for a brief period of time.
Voluntarily?
Yeah, it was voluntarily. It was a mutual decision. But, you know, when you're 8, you just do what you're told.
Of course.
And it was a transition. I went from Welch Chamberlain to Chamberlain. So.
And what was the family like that you were with?
They were very proper and really nice people. They really,
kind.
Yeah, very kind people.
Yeah.
But there was a strictness in the family that I wasn't used to.
Give me an example.
For instance, my clothing was a big issue for me when I was 8.
Like,
you know, when I moved in, I liked to wear Prince Purple Rain t-shirts.
Okay.
And I had, you know, I wore a little hat that said Danny on it in puffy paint, which I really liked too.
Okay.
And then when I moved in with this new family, it was very much, you know, plaid skirts, you know, taffeta dresses, raw silk, itchy tights. And we had to dress up for plane rides, things like this, where I was just not used to this level of formality at all.
Tell me, Dan, what the family of origin was like for you, what you remember of it.
Of our family?
Yes, your family. What was life like?
Well,
I
missed my Danny hat for one thing. But, our family was picture perfect. It was beautiful. I mean, we had, you know, we had a Shetland pony that we used to go when birthdays, we'd have, you know, rides, and all the kids would come over and we'd get on Buckley, our Shetland pony, and ride around on lead line. And we had a pool, and our father was in great shape and went swimming every day. And we used to I remember getting on his back and holding his neck, and he would just do laps, you know. And her mother was an actress who had sung
Boy,
too
she
loud.
She had some really prominent places in her soap opera career.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't realize how famous, at least I didn't realize, this is Diana, how famous our mother was we actually went back and looked at all of her clips.
Oh, I see.
And once Dan started posting her old soap clips on YouTube, there was fans coming out of the woodwork or the ether, whatever you'd call it on the internet, just being like, oh, we love Ann Williams. We miss her so much. She was our favorite character. People. She's really got people who are still interested in her work.
And in the soap opera she appeared in, Amanda, what were they like? Which ones?
She was on Search for Tomorrow for 11 years. She was on Edge of Night playing Margot Huntington. I think she was on that for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Then and she loved that soap because she got to be a villain. And she was a very nice person. And to play a villain was very exciting for her. She always liked that because all her other characters were fairly nice people.
Was she a good mom to all
of you? She was excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. She really was.
Okay, amazing. Take us back to how this idyllic lifestyle changed. How did that happen, Amanda?
Well, everybody went on a vacation except me, and the car broke down in South Carolina when they were on vacation. And my dad ended up flying up to Boston to visit his father at the end of the vacation, and our mom stayed down to get the car fixed and take it back home. And then he was going to fly home from Boston after seeing his father and decided that day not to rent a car and drive home. Well, on the way home, he had an accident and he died. And that just shattered our perfect life.
How so? Mm. Money?
Money, and there were a lot of... my dad was an entrepreneur, and he was a bust or bank kind of guy. He either had plenty of money or none. And it happened to be at a point where it was right in the middle of a deal that he was supposed to be working, and there was none. And our mother was really the financial supporter of the family at that point.
And her salary as a soap opera star was still carrying
pretty,
you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, at the time our father died, our mother was in between soaps. She had been killed on Edge of Night, bludgeoned with a fire poker.
Yeah, you say in the book she got killed three times.
She got killed. We love that first line. Our mother died three times. Yeah. We have two of them on VHS tape.
Right.
She was shot by Morgan Fairchild on Search for Tomorrow. That was her first death, and her second death was being bludgeoned on the Edge of Night. By Kim Hunter in a whodunit storyline that lasted several weeks. And then when our father died, she was out of work and then was diagnosed with cancer a month to the day. We have the medical records. She got that cancer diagnosis 1 month after our father died. And at the time, was still trying to get work doing commercials and whatever else. But the remarkable thing about our mother is that she, with the cancer diagnosis, was cast on Loving, which is an ABC soap opera, in the original cast. By the time she started this job, we really needed the money because our father, unbeknownst to our mother, had left her in terrible debt. And when Diana and I started working in earnest on this book, I'm an investigative reporter. I write for lots of magazines. And I had been reporting all the details around our parents' deaths for the last 5 years. So we had all of these records, and we added it up. He left our mother $1.2 million in debt.
Wow.
1983, which is...
1983. Yeah. So when your mother was discovered to have cancer, did everybody think it would be a very slow-growing process, that it was treatable, that she'd be fine? Dan?
Well, you know, I kind of really didn't know what it meant. I was 11 years old, you know, so I was just kind of looking to my older sisters to find out what's happening, and, you know, it was a scary process. Something was wrong, but I didn't quite know how to, you know, process it.
At the same time, there was some thinking on somebody's part that your dad didn't really die as an accidental driving death, falling asleep at the wheel, that somehow he was connected to the CIA and had been done in. Where did that come from, Amanda?
There were a lot of conspiracy theorists on my dad's side of the family, and they are very dramatic people, and they I just remember overhearing these discussions about it could have been, you know, something to do with his work he was doing in Honduras, because that's the last place that he had been doing some work, his entrepreneurial work. And I do remember my dad saying something about being in, I thought he called it the CIC when he was in the Army, but we don't have any records of any of that. Then Liz has looked into it pretty thoroughly.
I looked into it. You know, I remember my mother very specifically telling us that he worked for the CIA and that she thought his death was planned. You know, I was 13, Amanda was 16 when this all was happening. And so you're impressionable and you believe it. And frankly, it's far more heroic to think our father was killed in some undercover secret, you know, thing with the CIA, falling asleep at the wheel.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, very sadly, there were other rumors that it was planned and that he did it on purpose because he was in such terrible debt.
Oh, my.
That was a very painful thing to uncover as we were writing this book and realizing that that was one of the rumors.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the night he died? Do you all remember that, Dan?
Sure. I woke up to my mom crying, sitting on the edge of my bed crying, and her back was to me. It was a beautiful night, a full moon. I remember the shadows of the moon on all my toys and model planes, and my mom just crying and saying that Dad wasn't coming back, that God needed him for something.
Oh, God needed him.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
That's actually how we decided to write this book the way we did. It was because Liz wrote her memory of our father's death to me looking for some, you know, editorial feedback. And instead, I realized that I remembered it completely differently.
Diana Welch, Liz Welch, Amanda Welch, Dan Welch. The book is titled The Kids Are All Right.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, he's a European intellectual and Muslim scholar whose work almost always stirs up controversy. We talk with Tariq Ramadan, banned from the U.S. for the past 5 years, about Western culture, human rights, and contemporary Islam, plus revamping the federal salary structure, why many believe the 60-year-old GS system should be scrapped, while others say tweaking could fix its problems. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the National Museum of Women in the Arts, featuring equine and still life paintings by Clarice Smith through January 10th. More information at nmwa.org.
Support for WAMU's recent membership campaign comes from your contributions and from our in-kind food donor, Cake Love. For more information, visit WAMU.org and click on support.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And the title of this book, once again, The Kids Are All Right, a memoir written by the Welches. Diana, Liz, Amanda, and Dan. It's very interesting that instead of the kids are all right, it's the kids are all right, which to me suggests, as I know in my own family, the memories are different for each and every person. For you, Amanda, being 19, when your mom died, what was your memory of the family?
Of the family at that point?
Mm-hmm.
We were all, you know, it had been 3 years since mom's diagnosis to her death, and we kind of all changed a lot. We all became, you know, because the atmosphere around the house was very chaotic and nervous making and strange. You know, mom was in a coma for the last month of her life, and there was night nurses and day nurses, and we were all sort of fending for ourselves. So Liz and I just, you know, hung out a lot, and her friends came over a lot, and Dan was at boarding school.
Yeah.
So he was already at boarding school. I see.
And Diana had already left to live with her new family. So it was very much like a frat house with a person in the back room with nurses at the time of mom's death.
How could your mother afford boarding school for you?
I actually had a scholarship. I don't know. It couldn't have been for it couldn't have been for athletics or scholastics. So I don't know how he got a scholarship.
It was for singing.
But, yeah.
Our mother worked very hard to get Dan that scholarship, and it was to a special boarding school about an hour north of where we lived. She wanted Dan out of the house, I think. Amanda would probably be able to really talk more to that, but when she realized she was dying, she wanted Diana to move in with her guardians. She wanted Dan in boarding school. She didn't want her kids to actually watch her die.
I see.
Yeah.
How were your guardians selected, Diana?
It was a decision that my mother put to Amanda and Liz, actually. She, you know, for the longest time didn't want to admit she was dying. So she did not make any decisions until the 11th hour. And she called, you know, her two daughters in and were like, we need to figure this out. Where Diana's going to live. And two families that Liz babysat for sort of stepped up to the plate. The Stewarts, who she ended up living with, and the Chamberlains, who I ended up living with.
And
Liz made the decision that I would go to the Chamberlains.
Why?
And she would go.
Why?
Well, the Stewarts, who I'm actually still very close with, Daisy Stewart, she was my guardian. They were alternative hippies.
Lifestyle.
Uh-huh. I wanted to live with them because I didn't think I was going to have a curfew and I could probably drink wine with dinner. I was 16 and I thought Daisy Stewart was really cool. The Chamberlains seemed the most like the family that I grew up with. You know, mom, dad, you know, he drove a BMW. They went to the Bedford Golf and Tennis Club, which when we were growing up, we were members of the club. We went horseback riding. We had a very fairy tale existence. And the Chamberlains seemed much more modeled after that. They had two little girls. Diana would be the eldest, a little girl and a little boy. And they, like I said, you know, country clubs and whatever else. It just made the most sense to us that Diana would fit in and be really well taken care of.
Is that how you felt?
At the time, I just had no idea what was going on.
Sure.
And so when I moved in with this new family, I was sort of under the impression that it was temporary. And when this temporary visit went on and on and on, I started to kind of get the picture that I was going to be there for good. I think of myself as playing possum kind of for the 6 years I lived with them because I was very subdued in my mind, which is funny because the perspective of my friends at school was that I was loud and obnoxious and, you know, funny and all of this stuff. But I was just really thought I was very, you know, towing the line and being very proper.
And Dan, how did you feel about being sent off to boarding school?
Oh, I hated it. Oh, I hated every minute of it. Yeah. I was, you know, because of mom's sickness, you know, there was no strict rule in our house, you know. So I was able to go out and play with my friends at night and go down to Mount Kisco and go to the mall and play army and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, I had a really free childhood to go and experiment and have a lot of fun, you know. And then I think that's probably why I ended up in boarding school, quite frankly, you know, because I didn't know where I was half the time. But, you know, boarding school wasn't that at all. It was a very, you know, curfew, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning, you
right,
go have
right.
breakfast, you know.
You know, I think it's important to say that your mother sold the house you all lived in order to pay off some of these debts, Amanda.
Yeah, she made a deal. There was actually a loan that my dad had taken out for his business that my mother had to co-sign for him to get. So that was one of the big chunks of money that we owed. And so she made a deal with them that she would sell. We first sold our first house and built another house to live in. But then that second house, she made a deal with them because she knew she was dying that she would pay it back once she died. The house was sold. They would get their money back. So she had this negotiated settlement on how to pay back the money.
So then the question becomes, Liz, why did you think it was important to write this book?
Well, when back to Edinburgh University, I was reading As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, which is a story about a woman's death told from the different perspectives of the family. And Diana and I, as I said, were estranged at that point. And there is a chapter in As I Lay Dying where Vardaman, I think he's 7 years old, is watching his mother's coffin floating down a river. It's come off of their wagon, and there's a one-line chapter that says, "My mother is a fish." And I read that chapter. I'm sitting in Edinburgh University, hundreds, thousands of miles away from my family, and I thought, Diana is Vardaman. It just popped into my head. Like, her experience of losing our parents must have been so different. So then fast forward about 5 years, I started trying to write the story by myself. I was a budding journalist at the time. I interviewed Dan and Amanda and Diana about it. I interviewed people that knew our parents. I got all of my mom's medical records. And every time I sat down to write it, it just wasn't gelling. And the thing about my siblings is every time we get together, we share stories.
Yeah.
And they're always wildly different.
Yeah.
So I'll tell a version and Amanda always says, "That's not how it happened." And then, you know, Diana, when I wrote the chapter about my father's funeral, I wanted her to be my editor because she'd grown into such a beautiful writer. And she called me and she said, "Liz, I remember it totally differently."
And that's really what happens in families with two children, or in your case, families with four children. Why that title is so perfect. The kids are all right. What is your memory of your father's funeral, Diana?
Well, my father's funeral, I wasn't actually there. My mother kept me home because she thought it would be too sad. So there was a photograph of me and my father on his coffin. But I do remember his burial. We were all together and I was there for his burial. And I remember I was being held by my Uncle Russ, who bears a resemblance to my father. And the poor guy, I made him burst into tears because I was touching his face, because memories of my father are very tactile for me because I was four when he died. I remember his smell and his feeling. And so I was touching his face and I told him that he looked just like my daddy, and the poor guy fell apart.
We all fell apart.
Yeah. Every time I read that, I fall apart.
Yeah, I know.
And that's the beauty of this. You've each written your own chapters. Now, what is your memory of your dad's funeral burial?
This is Liz, and I was 13 years old when my father died, and I remember overhearing a conversation my mother had with Amanda, my very cool 16-year-old sister, and Amanda wanted to wear black leather pants to the funeral. And I remember thinking, I don't have anything black, and being really upset about that because my father was very dapper. He really prided himself on his wardrobe, Brooks Brothers, press shirts on the weekends. So it became incredibly important to me as a 13-year-old girl to have the appropriate thing to wear. My mother didn't think it was appropriate for a 13-year-old to wear black. And it was at that moment, that's when I burst into tears. That's what I got upset over, that I didn't have the right thing to wear.
How about you, Amanda?
I remember my strongest memory, I think, is of the viewing. It wasn't the funeral, but it was the viewing at night. And I had called one of my friends who was away at college, and she was the only one that I really cared to come. And we were all, you know, we all went up to the casket and everything. And Liz was surrounded by this, like, gaggle of 13-year-old girls, all sobbing, like hysterical, crying. And I was just sitting there like, what is going on here? It's like their parents didn't die. What are they crying about? But then when my friend walked in the door, I burst into tears.
Interesting. Mm. And you, Dan?
I think my strongest memory of that, it was just so awkward. The whole thing was really awkward. And I was just kind of standing in my corner with some friends and not knowing what to say, and they didn't know what to say. And we just kind of sat there quietly looking at each other. You know, it's very awkward.
You know, it's so interesting. I can remember when my own mother died, and there was indeed a viewing. I have to say, I hate viewings. Mm-hmm. And I was just sitting there, yeah, as you were, Dan. I was 19, but I was just sitting there, and I can remember aunts saying to me, "Diane, why aren't you crying?" Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sometimes you cry, and yeah, sometimes you hold it in.
Yeah. Yeah.
The way in which your mother tried to fight her own illness was interesting. She didn't just rely on doctors, did she, Liz?
No, she really turned to all kinds of alternative ways to beat the cancer. And one of the things that was so interesting about writing this book was getting to talk with my siblings about their memories, which were, of course, totally different because I wasn't there when, for instance, my mother told Dan that he had power in his hands. So she had healers come and lay hands on her. And my brother, there's a chapter in which he describes laying his hands on my mother. She did macrobiotic diets. She even went to revivals that both Amanda and Dan accompanied her to. Not that any of us believed that this was working, but we wanted to support her begrudgingly. I think we were all a little bit angry, but she really tried anything she could to get well.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And what were those revival meetings like, Amanda?
I remember one very distinctly. It was held in, I think it was a Catholic church in Mount Kisco, but it was a traveling tent show kind of feeling thing. And I remember we wheeled Mom in there, and people would go up to the front, and the preacher would lay his hands on the people, and they'd fall back in a hysterical whatever. And Mom went up and did that, and I just was like, this is such a bunch of crap that it's, you know, ridiculous. I just thought it was all charlatanism and horrible.
And you went too, Dan.
I did. I think, was that the one where I'm dyslexic, and so I wheeled our mother up. Mm-hmm. And so the preachers, you know, asked me what was ailing me, and I said, well, I'm dyslexic. And he told me that I should read the Bible and I'll be healed. And I said, I'm dyslexic. I can't read, man. And then I wheeled Mom off.
Like, right.
Speak my language. But what happened?
What did he manage to do for your mom?
Well, you know, she stood up out of the wheelchair, you know, and she, you know, she wanted to believe, you know. Mm-hmm. She was trying desperately not to die, not to leave us, you know. So, you know, he put his hand on her head and, mm-hmm, you know, she felt the power and she collapsed back into the chair and I wheeled her off. And
that was it.
That was mm-hmm. that.
Wow. And Diana, talk about the relationship that you developed with Nancy Chamberlain.
I would say it was a toughie. there was an element of fear for me, I think, because I was nervous that I would do something wrong and that I would, you know, be punished or not kicked out necessarily. I kind of felt stuck there, so I wouldn't get kicked out. But there was also a fear of her not wanting to be my mother as well, because she was my replacement, you know, my maternal replacement. And I really thought I was going to be there forever. So that was a struggle, I think, for the two of us, because I was also resistant to her being my mother, I think, to a certain extent.
So how did that play itself out?
I would say, you know, I had a photograph of my mom that I hid in my closet, because I felt that my new mother didn't like seeing my old mother around. So I hid it.
So you didn't put it out?
I didn't put it up on the wall.
Stand,
yeah, or, I hid it in my closet, and she found me in there with the picture one
with
time.
With the picture. How old were you at the time?
It was probably soonish after. I was probably 9, though. I think time had passed. I was definitely a part of this family. I had my own room at that point. I think my name had maybe was in the transitional period of being changed. And she was very kind to me. She said, you know, she said, you can put that up on the wall, you know,
if you like,
if you want. And I just remember feeling like I didn't want my mother seeing me treat another woman like my mother. I couldn't have that reminder, so I preferred it in the closet, actually.
But at the same time, didn't she withhold letters that Liz had sent to you?
You know, I would think so. I'm not positive that she did that because I don't know what letters Liz actually wrote to me. So it's hard to say that she actually did withhold them. But I don't remember getting very many. I remember getting a couple. But Liz claims she wrote lots.
I mean, my memories were writing letters to Diana, trying to call her. And then there's this one moment where the Chamberlains made a decision. They said they had been to a child psychologist and it was better for Diana to really become part of their family. We needed to schedule our appointments. And there was a moment where that exploded. I stopped by because Mr. Chamberlain said it was okay and Mrs. Chamberlain didn't realize I was coming by. So there was a fracture there. She got very upset with me. And that, I think, really did scar me. It made me feel like I couldn't get in touch with my sister as often as I would have liked to have. I did send letters, and I remember when Diane and I did get back together, she didn't remember getting them.
And you're hearing from Liz Welch, Diana Welch, Dan Welch, Amanda Welch. The book is titled The Kids Are All Right. We'll be right back.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Coming up next on A Prairie Home Companion, we'll infuse a little French flavor to the Midwest with Mark Stillman, an accordionist and a sound effects man, Fred Newman. He'll play that special Je ne sais quoi. That's A Prairie Home Companion, coming up at 11 on WAMU 88.5. Complete schedules are at WAMU.org.
I'm John Donvan, host and moderator of Intelligence Squared U.S., where Oxford-style debating comes stateside and takes on America's hot-button issues. The next motion up for debate, good riddance to mainstream media.
What are we defending here?
This is a transformational moment, but it's not a moment to toss out what has value.
That's Intelligence Squared on NPR, National Public Radio.
Tonight at 6 on WAMU 88.5.
As an active duty service member, listening to WAMU 88.5 helps maintain your readiness. Public radio brings you detailed coverage of current events, so listen, study, read, practice, and remember WAMU 88.5 during this year's combined federal campaign. Our CFC number is 91855.
I'm Renee Montaigne, and I'm a morning person. I'm at work by 12 a.m. Pacific time to get ready for Morning Edition.
I'm Robert Siegel. Wouldn't that make you a night owl?
It would if I was staying up, but I'm actually just getting up.
So while you're getting up to do Morning Edition, I'll be resting up for All Things Considered.
And when you're live on All Things Considered, mm-hmm. I'll be sleeping. No offense.
None taken.
In-depth coverage of news that happened overnight on Morning Edition.
In-depth coverage of the day's news on All Things Considered
from NPR News.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Rehoboth Beach Independent Film Festival, November 11th through 15th in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, showcasing 100 American and international features, shorts and documentaries, seminars and cultural events. Details at rehobothfilm.com.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And welcome back. Four people are here with me in the studio. All have the last name Welch. There is Amanda, the oldest. Then there's Liz. Then there's Dan and Diana. Their book, which they wrote together as a memoir, is called The Kids Are All Right. Someone has sent us an email saying, in effect, you guys were awfully lucky that you did not encounter the foster care in this country that so many have endured. That is horrendous. You must have heard about that, Amanda, and wondered what could have happened had you not been fortunate enough to have families willing to take you in. You, of course, went off on your own.
I did, and I actually wanted to take everybody and be the guardian for everybody, and that might have ended with everybody in foster care because who knows how that would have gone. So I think we are very lucky that everybody, and that we did end up with a plan that could be implemented.
What
after.
Did you go off to do?
I was at NYU. I dropped out after about a year after Mom died, and then I moved down to Virginia and lived there ever since.
And finished college?
I finished college 10 years later at UVA.
Good for you. And you, of course, Liz, went on to a career in journalism.
Yes. I went to Georgetown University and did my master's degree there as well, and then wound up in New York as a writer.
Wonderful. Dan, what are you up to?
For the past 6 years, I've been location scouting in New York for TV and movies. So I go and I find locations for television and film.
And had an education opened itself up to you? Did you get through college?
I didn't make it through college. I went to college, and it was really fun. But then I stopped.
And Diana, what about you?
I didn't graduate college either. I dropped out to go traveling, and I started my writing career then. Actually, I did some travel writing for a small newspaper called Night Magazine in New York. And after that, bought a motorcycle and rode across the country looking for the perfect place to live. And I ended up in Austin, Texas, where I still live. And I'm a reporter there and just had my first kid.
What would you say each of you has been the toughest part of your lives, Liz?
Well, when Diana and I started working on this book together, it hit me that it was not losing our parents, but it really was getting separated. No one else knew what I was going through the month after my mother died except my siblings. And to be living apart from them. We were in the same town. Amanda was in Brooklyn, but we were also paralyzed by grief and the shock of the loss that it didn't really strike me until Diana and I started in earnest to write this book that that was the most painful thing. It's why we wound up getting back together 5 years later when Diana winds up moving back in with Amanda. But that to me was I think the most painful thing.
How about for you, Amanda?
I think that the whole process of figuring out where everybody's going to go and then having it fall apart so horribly was the part that was hardest for me. And I just kept trying to make it all work the way Mom wanted it to. I thought what was written down was what she wanted, and that's what we should do. And when it all started going horribly awry.
How did it go awry?
The guardian that Dan was supposed to go with at my mom's funeral said, I can't do this. And we were all like, you said, you know, she's dead now. What are we going to do now? You know, we have nobody to make the decision. So this family, I actually went away for a trip that had been planned. And I came back from this trip and Dan was living with a family I'd never even met. I had never heard their name, mm-hmm. And I thought that was probably my most difficult thing, when I lost complete control of the whole situation.
What happened that day when that family said, not going to take him?
Well, he did give me a lovely tennis racket, which I thought was interesting, since I didn't really play tennis and I had nowhere to play it anyway. But he just said he was trying to put my mom at ease. Then he disappeared. Then Karen Kaiser stepped up, and she's a friend of my mom's who lives in the city, and she said, I'll take Dan. And then I think the town got involved and said that I shouldn't go live with a single woman in the city, and then I ended up with this family, and I was there for about 6 months until they kicked me out.
Till they kicked you out.
Yeah.
Why?
You know, I grew up with some freedom. like I said, I was able to go out and discover the towns and play, you know, army and all this kind of stuff. And they were very strict, and it was either by their rules or, you know, or the highway.
So when they kicked you out, then what?
Well, I called up Amanda, and I think I stayed with Amanda for a bit. Then I ended up staying with Karen Kaiser again.
And you, Diana, what was the most painful time for you?
I think the most painful time was when I realized that my siblings weren't going to come get me from my new family, and that I was part of a new, you know, expected to be part of this new family where I felt very uncomfortable. And I would say that was the most difficult, because the most joyous part of my life was when I was reunited and when I moved in with Amanda. And I was just sort of like, oh, I'm back with my people who understand me, because we are all very free-spirited.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Vanessa in Mount Vernon, New Hampshire. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
I live in New Hampshire, but I grew up in Bedford, and I worked my summer job in high school at the Bedford Golf and Tennis Snack Bar at school.
Oh, my goodness.
And I remember your mother. I don't remember you guys, but I just remember your mother coming, because I knew who she was on the soap opera, but I just remember her out of anybody, because she always had this funny, like, kind of fishing cap on.
Yeah.
And she was just really nice, and she wasn't like the typical, I hate to stereotype, but the typical country club mom that just hung around the pool and wasn't really actually very friendly to us who worked at the snack bar, but she always was. She was great, and I'm 49 now, but I still remember her.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
I can totally pass that on.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
That's a lovely memory. Thank you, Vanessa. To Charlotte, North Carolina. Monroe, thanks for joining us.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Hope all is well with you all.
Thank you.
My question is, what kind of relationship does the young lady have who was adopted by the Chamberlains? What is their relationship with her now, with her family?
Diana.
We're no longer in contact. Actually, after I was reunited with my family, I think I saw the Chamberlains once, and they made it clear that, similarly to the way they handled my relationship with my family when I moved in with them, they kind of wanted a clean break. And I've respected that ever since. Happily. I feel like I've been reunited with my family, and they're all the family I need.
Okay. But surely you must have some gratitude toward them.
I really do. It's true. I mean, I was always very safe when I was with them. I was never in any danger. And it was just a different way of life. And as a kid who had just lost my whole life, I was very resentful for this new life that I had.
Understand.
But it wasn't their fault.
Let's go to Southwest Michigan. Good morning, Marge. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. It was painful to hear you speak of viewing. I don't understand why that phrase is still used. Surely we don't go to a funeral home or whatever venue to view the body. We go to visit with the family. And I wish the term visitation or paying one's respects would be used. Because the Welch family expressed it. Their friends came to visit with them during that time, even though it was a painful time. That's just my thought.
It's absolutely true. I think there are some, and I have to say I'm one of them, who's never felt that an open casket helped.
Both of
mourn.
Our parents had closed caskets.
They both had closed caskets. Well, that's very different. There are many who...
We were just viewing a wooden box.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did that make you feel, viewing that wooden box?
For me, at my mother's funeral, it was very weird. I actually remember very clearly going up to the casket, because that's what everybody else was doing.
Sure.
And I felt so weird that I started giggling. Kneeling at my mother's casket, I had a fit of nervous giggles when I was 8 years old. So it was very weird.
I don't think that's unusual.
No.
I really don't. Thanks for calling. Now to Ellensburg, Washington. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning to you. Thank you for the call. And this subject brings back memories, because I'm the youngest of five orphans. We were 2 years old. I was 2 years old when my mother died, and five when my father died. And there's 10 years between us. And we were experiencing the same thing as you, but we went to an orphanage.
Wow.
And the thing that I want to really say is, you bet that all of you are all right and all right. And what's interesting is, when we get together, I have a brother who died, so there's only four of us, but when the five of us get together, it is such a riot.
Yeah.
Listening to tales.
Yeah.
And to talk about the past, and no, that didn't happen that way.
Yeah.
And we just laugh and laugh and carry on. And when you talk about the truth, you know, one of my favorite sayings is from Sophie's Choice, that says, when she says, truth, I don't even know what the truth is.
Yeah.
Well, we all know the truth, and it's what we see the truth as. And more power to you guys. And I wanted you to just talk for a minute about the problem that we've been having all through our lives and have finally acknowledged, and that is the problem of desertion.
Hmm. Wow, that's a good question. Like feeling deserted by your
parents? Exactly.
Sure.
When they die.
Yeah. That's a really...
Was there any anger?
I think for the older kids. I think you guys were
mad
at mom,
right? For you, Amanda?
Well, I do remember being... I think I was angry at my mom before her death more than after her death, because I was of an age where you don't really get along with your mother very well anyway. And it was all so sad and, you know, weird, and her being sick, and just... you know, messed up my whole life that was supposed to happen. I do remember saying, Liz and I had talked about this, like, it was so much easier with Dad's death because it was fast. It happened, it was shocking, but it was fast. We didn't have to watch him waste mm-hmm. away like our mom and be in such pain, and that was really difficult.
She was in a great deal of pain.
Great deal of pain
terrible,
at the end.
Yeah.
She moaned for a month, unconscious.
And she was at home. So at that time, Dan was in boarding school and Diana was at the Chamberlains. But Amanda and I would come home and we'd hear her moaning. And that still can chill me.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It would seem to me that one of the great regrets that each of you might have is the lack of opportunity to speak with your parents as adults. Liz?
Oh, sure. There have been so many moments in my life where I wished my parents were there. But that is the joy of writing this book with my siblings. It gets me emotional even talking about it, because they've always been there. After we reunited, Dan, Amanda, and Diana have been at every one of the milestones in my life, including walking me down the aisle. I got married in May, and Diana was my maid of honor. And Dan and Amanda were proudly marching in front of me. And I feel like, as much as I miss my parents, they really do live in my siblings. So I feel very fortunate that we have such a close relationship. And I think it's as a result of the loss that we suffered together.
Was your mother conscious when she died?
No.
She was not?
She was not.
How long had she not been conscious?
About a month,
It was about a month.
Really?
Yeah. Since we had a Thanksgiving meal with our mother that I write about in the book, and it was her last great act. She was an actress, and she wheeled out in her wheelchair, 80 pounds. Diana came from the Chamberlains. Dan came from boarding school. We all sat around the table. Amanda and I cooked, and she ate everything on her plate after not having eaten anything for the last 2 months, raised a glass of champagne, toasted us all. And then went back to her bedroom, and literally the next day is when the moaning started. She lost consciousness. So that was our great parting gift from our mother. We had this memory of this Thanksgiving meal together. And then she went away.
Do you remember that, Dan?
You know, I was just thinking about that. I don't remember any of the details. I do remember seeing Mom with a champagne in her hand.
A woman after my own heart. Amanda, how about you? What do you remember about that last meal?
I do remember us all cooking together, which is something we do love to do together. We do celebrate all the holidays together, cooking together. And some of Liz's friends were there. Karen was there. We had all these people around that, you know, loved our mom. And it was a really special day.
Diana?
I don't remember it at all.
You don't?
I don't. No, I don't remember it at all. The last memory I have of my mother is I woke up my new mother in the middle of the night, and I really wanted to see my mom. So she drove me to my house in the middle of the night, and I saw mom, you know, unconscious in her bed. And I saw her row of wigs on the dresser, and that's my last memory of her.
Boy, that's tough. And then your foster mom took you back home.
Yes.
And that was it?
And that was it.
Gosh.
Yep.
Well, you have all put together a book of real thoughts and memories to share with everybody. I congratulate you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you. The book is titled The Kids Are All Right and the Welches, Diana, Liz, Amanda, and Dan, have created this lovely memoir. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us, Diana.
And thanks for listening, all. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good morning, a Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Asendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
Many seniors are being forced to choose between vital necessities and essential home repairs.
Rebuilding Together in Northwest D.C. helps seniors stay in their homes.
Rebuilding Together provides free home repairs and modifications for seniors who would otherwise be unable to make them.
The We Are Family Network in D.C. advocates with landlords and the government on behalf of seniors.
The We Are Family Network also